Here at the Sociology of Everything podcast, we acknowledge the people of Gonayarta, whose land this episode was mainly produced on, and whose past and present elders we pay our respects to.
Hi, I'm Eric Sue.
And I'm Louis Empress.
And welcome to another episode of Lou and the Sioux, a podcast about sociology, brought to you by UniSA, the university that has a surprisingly diverse workforce. Yeah, it used to tout this, I think, on online documents.
Interesting.
That has one of the most diverse workforces if you look at the number of countries that are represented by its staff.
Well, the thing that I always find interesting is that diversity changes between different areas. And, yeah, you know, I'm not going to call out any of my colleagues in the department.
But I will say I'm one of those people, obviously. Yeah. I'd be very surprised if there was another Taiwanese American working at this university.
Yeah.
Although I could be wrong, and I'll go another step further. I'm relatively confident that I'm the only Taiwanese American who does a Trump repression regularly who works at this university.
You know what? I hope so. I hope you're the only person who does a regular Trump impersonation full stop.
In this episode, we're going to continue a discussion that we started in a previous episode about feminist standpoint theory. So we recommend that you listen to that first before you listen to this one. In that episode, we looked at Dorothy Smith's contribution to feminist standpoint theory. And in this episode, we're going to look at how feminist standpoint theory has been expanded, how it's been contested, and how it's been broadened. I think that's true of most social theories in general. Would you say, Louis, that when social theory is produced, it's rarely just left as is?
Yeah.
People tinker with the edges, yeah. They challenge it, they spin it off in new directions.
Yeah. And that's not a criticism of that original theory, because that's going to be grounded in a particular research question, in a particular subject matter, and then other people will take it and apply it to what they're interested in and their experiences, and that'll broaden it and enrich that social theory.
That's right. And so in this episode, we're going to look at a notable attempt to do that when it comes to feminist standpoint theory. We're going to look at Patricia Hill Collins' famous text, Black Feminist Thought. And I think this text is remarkably interesting, and it gets us to think about new things when we're interested in standpoint theory. And in particular, I think one of the main contributions that Collins makes to feminist standpoint theory is to broaden how we understand difference. So one of the key contributions this text makes is to try to introduce a new social characteristic into the discussion, namely race. So in this piece, Collins talks a lot about Black feminist thought or Black feminist experience. And I'm curious, Lily, what's significant about Collins doing this?
Well, I think there's two significant things. The first one is quite a specific point, and that is that when Collins reads and looks at feminist standpoint theory, she's obviously a big fan and thinks the ideas are really important and powerful ideas. But she also says that there's a few things missing from it, because as she writes, when she looks at her experience as an African-American woman and when she looks at the experience of African-American women, she thinks there are a lot about how they are both oppressed and how they resist oppression that isn't acknowledged in the standard feminist standpoint theory. And in fact, her key point is that feminist standpoint theory kind of treats all women as the same.
At least it has the potential to treat them as the same.
Yes, it, absolutely. And it can treat their experience of oppression as just being that because they're women, they're dominated by society, by men who create the rules and ideas and everything else. But what she says is actually, as an African-American woman, you experience a different type of oppression to what a white woman would experience. And she wants to broaden standpoint theory to be a bit more nuanced and understands how different people, not just based on their gender, but based on their race, and in fact other things as well, their ability and other aspects, how they experience oppression and how they resist it.
I think putting forward a more nuanced understanding of feminist standpoint theory is a really good way of framing what Collins is trying to do. And I think we can especially see this in our discussion of the different types of oppression that there are. She says that normally when we think of oppression, it's easy to think of it in an additive way. There's the additive model of oppression, And that to me is something that I see all the time. It's when we think of domination and oppression in relatively simplistic terms, it's either or. It's the idea that there are different social characteristics that each of us has that we can determine to either be oppressed or oppressing. If I am of a certain race, if I'm maybe living in a society that privileges a certain type of ability, you know, if I'm disabled, my sexual orientation, religion. My religion, age, you can keep going down the list. But if we think of it in an additive way, we can think of things in a pretty black and white term.
It's kind of mathematical, I think. It's sort of like you get +2 for privilege if you're white. You get +2 for privilege if you're straight. You might get -1 for privilege if you're poor. And it's just that sort of formula.
And so Colin says she wants to advance a theory of oppression that's a little bit more nuanced. And so she talks about how it's better or it's more productive to think of oppression in interlocking terms. What is Colin trying to get at here?
So what she's saying is that it's not just about adding up your score, so to speak. It's about looking at your specific and unique position. Myself, I'm not sure if you can sense my privilege through the speakers, but I am a straight, white, probably upper class, male.
Yeah, it's palpable.
I think I'm on the sort of higher, well, not even the hierarchy, in the matrix that Collins establishes, which we'll go on to talk about. I'm in a very specifically privileged position, but it's a unique position. Eric, yourself, I mean, you might want to talk about your position within the hierarchy, but the key point is that each position is unique and different. It has its own relationships with other positions. It's not just about being slightly more privileged or less privileged than everyone else. It's about having unique relations based on the specific position.
The interlocking nature of oppression, I think it's a very powerful concept because it's trying to understand how different forms of oppression can be linked.
Yeah.
Not that they stand side by side with one another, they don't have anything to do with one another, but that certain forms of oppression can actually feed into others. And also, what the point is trying to get at is that we can rarely think of people as being fully oppressed or fully oppressors.
So what's an example of this, Eric?
I think a really good example that we can think of is to appeal to one that's briefly mentioned by Donna Shampo and Susan Shaw in their article in Feminist Teacher, when they're trying to, well, teach people how to teach the interlocking nature of oppression. And they briefly mention the stereotype of Asian women as being like geisha-like. And what they mention is that oftentimes students or people in general, they can easily recognize how that's like pretty racist. But what they don't recognize is how gender also feeds into that stereotype as well. And I think we can go even a step further. What's interesting to me about the depiction of Asian women as being geisha-like, or to be more direct, like more subservient, more meek, is that it shows how different social characteristics combine in unique ways to produce various forms of privilege, but also various forms of oppression. So in the case of Asian women, their femininity and their race positions them in a way that's actually very different than, say, a woman of a different race. So whereas Asian women are oftentimes thought to be very quiet, very subservient, this is radically different from how oftentimes how African American women have been framed in certain parts of the world, especially in the U.S., when Michelle Obama was the first lady of the United States, this was a big debate, right? They oftentimes characterized her as being angry and loud anytime she just said something very sensible like, hey, we shouldn't be eating like burgers at school every single day. Burgers and pizzas. Yeah. You know, we need to make diets a little bit healthier.
Outrageous. Honestly, in an American context, outrageous.
But what's interesting, though, is this shows how, again, different social characteristics combine in unique ways and that they're inextricably linked. So in the case of Black women, the femininity that they share with Asian women is expressed and understood in very different ways.
Mm.
Louis, can you give an example of the interlocking nature of oppression?
Well, I suppose I wonder if the contemporary notion of a Karen would be one, so to speak. I mean, if you think about a Karen, there's a pretty clear image in our head of what we're describing. We're describing a middle or upper class white woman. So it's a position that would sit at the intersections of all of those different characteristics. And there's been some examples like, you know, I think it was Central Park in the US where a Karen, so to speak, had an argument with a black man and threatened to call the cops on that man. Yeah. And you can see that there's a power relationship at play where a white woman in distress has power over a black man because of the history of police violence and these sorts of things. That only works because of the intersections of those two positions. But then at the same time, I think we need to be cautious maybe with the notion of the Karen as well, because for some people that suggests that labeling someone a Karen is a way of trying to shut them down and not let them have a voice.
I think, yes, we do need to be very careful in terms of the labels and terms we use, especially when it comes to the concept of a Karen. But I think it is actually still quite illuminating because it hits at Collins's point that you can be both pressed and also oppressing.
Absolutely.
And the structural position of a white woman in the US, especially, of course, this might be linked to class as well, exerts a certain type of privilege that perhaps is not found in other types of women. So how do we graphically represent the interlocking nature of oppression? How do we visualize it? And Collins comes up with a pretty interesting way to do so. She comes up with the concept of the matrix of domination. So what is the matrix of domination? Or should I just say, what is the matrix?
Well, the matrix of domination, it kind of sounds like a very scary ball game. Sort of like I've been playing the matrix of domination. And I suppose in a way we are all playing in the matrix of domination.
Yeah.
As a straight white guy, I'm winning this game. But the matrix of domination is a way of visualizing what we've been discussing. And essentially, it's just a move beyond thinking of domination and oppression and power as a single linear scale. And Collins wants to move away from that and say, no, if the way you experience domination is impacted not just by any one variable, by lots of variables, then we need to come up with a matrix, a different way of visualizing that, where there are indices for race, class, religion, ethnicity, gender, and you're positioned in a point where you intersect all of these different things. So that's part of it. That's the kind of key part that we've been discussing. And then there's another part, because she says, there are also different levels to the matrix of domination. Now, this might sound confusing, but actually all she's referring to here is the fact that we experience domination and we resist domination at different levels, all the way down from our own brain and our own psychology, all the way up to the big institutions in society.
So, like, the psychological part of it could just be the idea that there are certain things we know or know to be true, which actually end up perpetuating a broader social inequality.
Absolutely.
And actually, this also, I should say, this also is very much, you know, hits to the core of her other argument in this piece, which is that domination and knowledge are linked. But let's look at the other forms of domination. You said there's the...
There's a cultural level as well. So the cultural level is about those shared norms and beliefs that exist within communities. So if we think about ideas like what is an appropriate behavior for a woman and a man in Australia, and these notions around what's appropriate behavior, and do they have a power element to them? For instance, often in conversations, as my wife regularly tells me, women who have strong opinions and who speak up in conversations get labeled bossy or shrewd or these things. Whereas for men, it's considered a sign of power and being decisive. And so that idea is something that's cultural. It's sort of communicated. We might walk out of the meeting and I might say, oh, Sharon really had a lot to say in there. Whereas if it was Bob, I might be like, geez, Bob had some good, you know, some strong authority. That's exactly right. Yeah. So that's a cultural idea. But once again, just to quickly jump back to the individual level, for a woman after a meeting, they may even police themselves. They may even think, did I talk a bit too much in that? Whereas a man's going to think, nailed it. What a meeting. And I'm obviously generalizing, but, you know.
And then the third level is the institutional.
Mm. And so that's really about how these things connect to the practices of institutions, of churches, of schools, of parliaments, and how these things embed oppression. And, you know, there are some obvious examples, like laws that favour one racial group over another, that sort of thing. But one other interesting point that Collins mentions is that different forms of oppression are more active at different levels. So if we go back to gender, for instance, I mean, there used to be a lot of laws on the books that gave men power over women. Women were legally obliged to give up their jobs when they got married, for instance. They weren't allowed into pubs, which is something I've seen to mention in a few episodes. I'm not sure why it proves a lot of points, that fact. Mm. But now those laws are broken down, but the oppression's still there. Collins just says it's moved from an institutional level down to a more cultural and psychological level.
So Collins is really helping us to better understand how domination or oppression or marginalization can occur.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to focus in particular on how she drills down into knowledge being implicated in all of this. So I think if you take seriously what she's trying to say, the implications for feminist standpoint theory are quite manifold. Even though she's coming from the perspective of Black feminism, she's actually making a point that has resonance for all other types of social characteristics. And it's because she's really trying to move us away from the idea that you're either oppressed or you're not.
Mm-hmm.
And that oppression actually operates in a multitude of different ways, as you identify with the different levels, but also different social characteristics, different social categories have different influences. And they also change anytime new variables are added. So again, it's not just simply that you can stack one on top of the other. She's trying to say that some forms of domination are somehow implicated in the domination of people in other ways.
Mm-hmm.
And so I want to actually then bring us to talk about a specific quote of hers that I think helps us to elucidate one of our key arguments. This is a segment we like to call Say What?
I joined in on that one.
I like that, Larry. Where we look at a quote in need of further explanation. Collins writes, "Each group speaks from its own standpoint and shares its own partial situated knowledge. But because each group perceives its own truth as partial, its knowledge is unfinished. Each group becomes better able to consider other group standpoints without relinquishing the uniqueness of its own standpoint or suppressing other groups' partial perspectives." What do you think this quote's trying to tell us?
The first thing it's telling us, and this is really drawing heavily on that standpoint theory that Collins is so influenced by, is that forms of knowledges are partial. They're not absolute truth necessarily. She's not saying there's no truth out there, but she's saying when someone has an opinion, when they have their own knowledge, it's influenced by their own specific position on that matrix of domination. Mm. And it's not something that can encompass everyone's position on that matrix of domination. It's a partial knowledge. It is relevant to that person. It's informed by that person's experience.
Mm.
So that's a key part of that.
So going back to the beginning of this episode, she's trying to get us to think about the dangers of conflating or subsuming experiences of certain social groups.
Mm.
And I think this term partial is very, very key, that we only have one piece of the puzzle.
Mm.
We have one piece of the puzzle, and that this also extends not just to someone like you, Louis, a white dude from a well-to-do background. I think that's probably safe to say, right?
Yes, it is.
Living in Australia. But it also applies to people like me and other people who have some marginalized quality about them.
Yeah. And there's a very practical element to this, because essentially she's saying when we examine someone's ideas, when we critique what someone's having to say, this should be part of our thought process. We should think who they are, what their, you know, background is, and how that's influencing their ideas.
And so this idea that we bring to bear only partial perspectives when we produce knowledge in the social sciences, I think is a very key one. And it's actually what informs our next segment, which I think I hear the sound for, Louis. It's playing again. And that's the sound of a segment we like to call Wouldn't You Know Smart People Know Stuff, where we bring in a distinguished scholar to help us understand in a deeper way a topic we've been discussing. So welcome, Dr. Francis Weil. Francis is a lecturer in Aboriginal Studies in the Justice and Society Academic Unit at UniSA. She's a Mark II woman and has done a lot of interesting research. It seems like you're doing research on Indigenous methodologies. And I also see here that you've done a collaboration with people in Sweden at Uppsala around climate change and Sami cultures. Mm-hmm. So welcome to the podcast. We're really thrilled to have you on it.
Minyana, manina budni, gana yirtana. Dear brothers, it's good we meet on Ghana land. Thank you for having me. And yeah, I had to speak a bit of Ghana there because we're on Ghana land. I'm really excited to do this podcast with you.
In this episode, we're looking at how feminist standpoint theory, or standpoint theory more broadly, mm-hmm. has been extended, how it's been, I guess, broadened in recent years. And we're just interested to hear your thoughts about it more broadly. I think one of the key things that I think standpoint theory alerts us to is that we can't take knowledge, especially in the social sciences, at face value. We have to be critical. We have to be reflexive about it. So I'm wondering if you can help us do that. So what's useful about questioning the idea of what constitutes knowledge?
Well, thank you for a wonderful question. And I think that it's such a rich area that you're asking about. And I want to pay some homage to Professor Martin Nakata, who wrote about Indigenous standpoint first up at the Torres Strait